I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and illustrator Trevor Henderson. We often mythologize the creatures of movies from decades past, which have seared themselves into our brains. The xenomorphs of Alien, the predator of predators, the gremlins, etc. A well-designed and well-executed creature can make or break a story. Cam, I know you're a fan of the new James Wanian invention Malignant, and regardless of how you feel about his filmmaking abilities, a modern master of monsters is Guillermo del Toro for fascinating creatures like The Pale Man. Our guest today is someone who knows a thing or two about creating the perfect creature, given that he's the designer of creepypasta favorite Siren Head. Google at your peril. Trevor, can you walk us through, to you, what makes an effective creature?
Oh, for sure. Well, first of all, that's an amazing company to be mentioned in. I loved Malignant so much.
I was going to say, I think I probably watched Malignant because Trevor said to watch Malignant too. A literal influencer of me when it comes to weird monsters.
I think I told you before when I first met you is that you are a superhero to my small person whose Siren Head is everything right now.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, there's tons of kids that love my monsters, and that's not anything I set out to do, but it's so weird and so cool. And that means a lot. But as you were saying, I'm not an expert in any shape or form, but there's a few things I wrote down here on a little post-it note on my computer just to things that I look out for when I'm trying to design a monster, I guess, for some spooky internet picture or something. And it's trying to emphasize a distinctive silhouette, because the silhouette's really important. And it'll also help you kind of differentiate it from a lot of other creatures where, you know, if you're looking at like the details, it might be easy to fall into a very similar shape to everything else, which is like, you know, the elongated humanoid figure that's very popular. Or there's like,
but that comes from Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's, I think about that and that like creepy thing coming down the stairs with like the elongated fingers. And that's all the origin of that visually from cinema.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, for a long time, I think we're getting out of it now, but for a long time after Cloverfield came out, every monster was a Cloverfield with the big like bat arms and the gray skin and whatnot.
I read a fascinating thing, which I can never find, and I always want to dig up again, that was about essentially like, it was like an anti-capitalist thing about the Cloverfield monster and a troll from Lord of the Rings. And I guess because special effects companies are so pressed for time and budget that they quite often are recycling assets. And they were saying that like capitalism is the reason we have so many Cloverfields.
That totally makes sense. And you can see like, you can see the family tree going all the way down to like the thing from Stranger Things and like the monsters in Quiet Place are just like exactly smaller Cloverfield guys. I just try and look at silhouette. I try not to go too complicated. You do like two weird things on a monster, and anything over that, and it gets a little weird. I think it gets a little too bogged down. You work from what scares you personally. Usually I'll just get a photo of like, you know, someone has sent me, because that's where most of my photos come from. People on the internet send me them, and I have a big folder on my desktop of their like darkened driveway or whatever. And I'll just try and think about what would be cool or scary to see there. To fit that space.
That's so eerie. How do you like walk alone? Do you have an animal you have to walk? Because this seems like it would be very daunting.
No, I just have a little cat. So she just chills next to me, and I don't have to walk anyone in any dark alleys.
Oh, good.
She's always good. Yeah, so I just try and think what would be there if I was going to put a monster there.
How much does mechanics and actual like biological force mean to you? Like, I mean, you invented Siren Head, so there's like a human aspect to that. But like, yeah, how much does that kind of like, this has to function in reality and the laws of physics apply?
My literal next point is don't be afraid to play with surreal elements, give or take real world biology for effects. So there's a point where it starts being detrimental to it being scary when you focus on how much it works in the real world. And it starts less being something that's frightening and more like, you know, like a drawing, like a nature doc, a nature drawing, an anatomical drawing. So I'm not afraid to make it just make no sense at all. But also you can play with elements of it making sense in something that doesn't make sense to make it scarier and vice versa. And then the last thing I wrote was human elements, unexpected human elements. And something that has no human elements is always really off-putting and spooky, I think. And I just try and do that, I guess. And then I just try not to repeat what's come before. I do a lot of like fleshy boys, like too much. You guys are just like made of meat. I'm trying to move away from that a little bit.
Clive Barker would appreciate that. So
yeah.
When you're looking at like you and I were talking about horror icons, and I talked about a bit about that in the intro before we started the show. Is there something for you about coming up with a mythology that kind of needs to like continue on? Like we've talked about you and I before the show started, we're talking about Pinhead and how many different ways people have used Pinhead and the way they've changed everything. Same with Leatherface; it's always changing.
Yeah.
Do you feel like mythology should be able to change along with a character if you've created a solid enough character?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like part of the enduring ability of characters like this that are kind of iconic is that they can be reinvented. And it doesn't really tarnish what's come before, in my opinion. Like, I'm not one of those people who is super angry about sequels or even remakes or anything like that.
I don't know. I'm going to get pretty angry about one of the sequels of one of today's movies, but that's okay.
That's true. That's fair. But you know, it's still there, right? You don't. Both of you and I can choose not to watch.
That is correct. We can choose not to watch it, which I did. So good work.
Only watch the good ending, not the bad forced upon ending. And
some people have good endings. Some people have endings thrust upon them. So, you know.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. So you know, I think it's kind of a compliment if a character can withstand that and still maintain the interest level of an audience to go back and check out what some new producer is doing for it or whatever. Is it always successful? Very often, not at all. But you know, it's cool that they can do that. I think it works. Yeah.
Agreed. All right. Well, let's get into our first movie today. And we're going to be talking about some creatures, because although the creatures in our first movie are well thought out and memorable, they're only part of what makes the film The Descent so effective. It's a movie that I would one day like to see in the theater, completely in the dark with a killer sound system. But it's equally as effective in transporting you into a claustrophobic space while you're on a couch with a blanket and an animal on your lap. As we venture into this one, please be warned the movie deals with claustrophobia, gore, and betrayal, as well as child death. We'll also probably spoil the heck out of it. And trust me, this is very spoilable. All right, who wants to take the plot summary on this one?
I mean, I'd prefer this one to the next one.
Totally.
It's a little
we'll
more straightforward.
We'll leave that one for our expert, Trevor. All right, Cam, go ahead. You can take the easy one.
Number one, I love that you gave a trigger warning to betrayal.
It's a thing. Are you familiar with this website, doesthedogdie.com?
Yeah. Oh, let me tell you, I professionally use MrSkin.com, I also professionally use Does the Dog Die.
And that's one of the triggers that they give for this. And I was like, okay, I can see it, because my mom actually doesn't like stuff where that's a big thing for her. She's like, does this happen? I'm like, yep. She's like, I'm out. So
I just feel like betrayal and horror, you kind of come in expecting
We've
a little.
We've all seen Yellow Jackets.
Anyway, yes.
It's a big part of this one, though.
Yeah, it's true. This is a very, if you like Yellow Jackets and haven't seen the Descent, get on it.
Yeah.
The Descent is kind of a bunch of movies in one. And as you say, I think even it's hard to even give a plot summary without spoiling stuff. So if you've never seen it, just know it's a great horror movie. Everybody agrees. Watch it. Pause right now. But yeah, The Descent is about character Sarah. She's a part of a group of women who like to do kind of extreme sports. At the end of one of their vacations, in the middle of some light drama, in an accident, her husband and child are killed. It obviously sends her on a bit of a spiral, and the film picks up when she is returning for the first time with this group of friends to go spelunking in some caves. But one thing leads to another. They end up in a cave that is not the cave they're supposed to do. They don't want to do the baby cave, so they go to a more extreme, off-the-map cave. Things start to go wrong in the cave, and then that compounds eventually to a level where things are full of monsters, and they're fighting to survive.
And then eventually fighting each other.
And fighting each other, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when you say betrayal, the interesting thing is they actually set up the human conflict almost immediately.
Yeah.
So you have that in your head the whole time.
Yeah.
This is a companion piece, I would say, to Neil Marshall, who is the director and co-writer's first film, Dog Soldiers, mm-hmm. which is, if you've seen that one, sure. that one's also a lot of fun. Dog Soldiers is a run-up for this one. If you've seen that one, it very, very much feels close, except for that's a band of all male soldiers and one female zoologist. She's a zoologist. She's not even a cryptozoologist. Fighting, trapped in a farmhouse, fighting all these werewolves that are coming in to get them, except for they're not in a tiny cave. They're in a giant woods in a tiny farmhouse. So it's got the same amount of gore, but like humor in the gore. Like at one point, a dog is like eating someone's intestines, and they're like, "Bad dog!" Like it's silly, and, you know, fun and weird. This one kind of, it has moments of humor, but then it just completely eradicates it. It's like a movie that gets rid of all humanity on the back end.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. And you can see that's a thing he's interested in. Like, it's very interesting when you read interviews. You can't come at him with any question about this movie he has not thought of. And I love when somebody's like, yeah, this reminds me of like the ancient text of Going to the Underworld. He's like, yes.
Like, oh, okay. Well, it is like you look at his list of influences. So from Deliverance, The Thing, The Shining, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, you can see all this. Like, were there any particular moments where you got smarty pants about this, Trevor, where you're like, oh, I know what he's doing. I know where that's from.
Not really. The one that stuck out last time I watched as like in a direct reference was the moment when the main character whose name slips my mind rises out of the pool of blood and kind of like an Apocalypse Now kind of moment. But the rest of it is definitely there when you bring it up in terms of influences. Not so much like direct rips or anything though. I think it does a really good job kind of pureeing all those influences into one thing.
I think, and then, of course, you bring up Deliverance, and I'm like, oh, because I saw it as Carrie. Like, here's the blonde woman covered in blood coming up with the big blue eyes, and she's about to wreak vengeance, right? So it's interesting that, like, as it feels like a horror movie lover's horror movie. Do you know what I mean?
Totally,
like,
there's
but it's also something of its own, as you mentioned, where you're like, if you're really thinking about it, and you're like, oh, this is resonant of blank, but he's tapping into such primal fears that I think all of those movies, which are amazing, also are tapping into, that you're going to have that sort of resonance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that he went on and did a movie called Doomsday that is like, if you watch that one, he's not hiding in any way, shape, or form. Like, he is kind of in The Descent, his influences. Like, half that movie is The Road Warrior, half that movie is, you know, Camelot. There's a bunch of, it's just mixed all together. But The Descent, I feel like he's definitely like a little finer mixing is happening there.
It's kind of weird. I get what you're saying. Neil Marshall is an interesting director because The Descent almost seems separate from all the rest of his movies.
Yeah.
You can kind of see the through line because he is sort of a tongue-in-cheek. Though now he's also become the like medieval guy, which is interesting.
He
started doing Game of Thrones and now he's just like everything's medieval all the time.
Yeah. It almost feels like the first half of The Descent is him like restraining himself and like really trying to do something subtler, and then he just fully, like, you know, he lets his belt loose and does like his trademark, what became his trademark horror action gore thing.
There's a lot of eye gouging in this movie.
There's a lot of eye gouging.
I will say, I forgot, considering it's like a film that famously has these scenes of people in a giant pool of blood, I still was kind of shocked. I'd forgotten how gory it was.
It's so gory. But I do feel like the first half, when he's restraining himself, is almost unbelievably scary. Like, it's the one long breath you're holding for an hour straight. And then, you know, I was talking to friends and they were like, you know, it's almost like as soon as the monsters show up, I can breathe because it's something they can tangibly fight and make a difference against. Whereas before, they're just like completely trapped in this uncaring environment that is just doesn't care whether they live or die, and there's nothing they can do to fight against it.
I think what's interesting to me and is so effective in this movie is this idea of momentum. Like, you talked about restraint, and they are literally trapped in this cave, and like especially the sequence with the squeeze, which I wasn't claustrophobic, and then I did that squeeze scene is so uncomfortable, and the way he shoots it, so uncomfortable, and that whole bit in the first half just feels so like restrained, and then when the creature shows up behind her, spoiler alert, in the fantastic, very 2000s shot with the like infrared camera, when like they're like, okay, and go, the rubber band releases and you just, you know, fly from there. And even
absolutely,
and even in both endings, the franticness of her, of Sarah's escape and the release, you're like, okay, that's the end of the rubber band, that's really cool, that's the tail end kind of flapping in the breeze.
And I totally, like, you know, like, it's easy to say like, oh, I wish the rubber band never snapped, because that tension is so good. But in terms of it being like a fully fleshed out film and it like being satisfying to an audience, maybe that would be unsustainable. And you kind of need that action towards the end, maybe.
That's the component, I think, of the next movie we're going to be talking about, because we'll get into it. The reason why a lot of people do not like our second film is because they find it's too much of that rubber band, that they don't get enough of this release snap at the end, although I will argue that release snap hurts. However, this one is the other thing that I think is really interesting is when people talk about this movie, they don't talk about it's a band of women. They're just like, it's just these people trying to survive. And that's so rare in horror. And there are some people who, of course, when it first came out, were like, you've hypersexualized them. I don't think that happens here at all. And they deliberately went out to make sure that didn't happen. There's no weird sex scenes. They never like cut to the affair. They like the women are like appropriately dressed for what they're doing. Like it's really interesting to me that that was thought about.
That's a wild complaint. I've never heard that, because it seems like there'd be a lot of ways he could have gone in that direction if he wanted to, and he just absolutely does not.
Yeah, and it sounds like he fought, to hear him talk, fought against that quite a bit, too, with his producers, which is interesting. And like you say, it's very interesting because, and tell me if you disagree as a woman, Becky, but I feel like this is also a pretty good, like, group of women movie, because I think a full group of women horror is still pretty rare.
Yeah.
It's often like a sorority house or something like that. So it's not often adult women with adult women conflicts. And I think you really get the feeling, and actually, Neil Marshall is somebody who I think quite often has women leads, but he really cared about not screwing that up, which I think is quite interesting,
too. Very early on, before people were telling them to do it, he took it to a bunch of his female friends who he respected and said, can you read this? What did I get wrong? Right? He really got that influence, knowing, like, I have a point of view that is specific to my personal experience. Perhaps I need some insight on what this would look like from somebody else. And I think that makes this movie so much stronger as a piece. And also that these characters are so believable, and you have, like, kind of a distinct personality without having to be like, oh, she's the sexy one, she's the quirky one, she's the partier. You get a bit of the partier, but you're like, no, that's just kind of, you know, she's that chick. You don't ever get like, here's the archetypes that you are now to connect with, identify with one and hope for their survival. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely come across as people, and it's kind of shocking how rare you can get an ensemble of women in a film, and even to this day, and not have it fall into these weird tropes and weird patterns.
But I also think that's why the betrayal aspect is so often talked about, and why it shows up on the trigger warning here, is because these women have to trust each other for the kind of activities they do. And especially for this, and the fact that the betrayal was so deep on a personal level by one of them just makes everything even worse. And that when everyone's like, oh no, she left us to die, now you have to take her down, is like, it just, watching the unraveling, like the rubber band, is just so... it becomes satisfying, you know?
Yeah. And especially even just like when they find out that it wasn't, they were lied to basically and told they were going to a really easy baby cave. And it's like this unmapped monster cave from prehistory or whatever. that alone is just the biggest end all be all betrayal for me, because it's doomed them all.
Yeah. It's also interesting, though, because I do think he doesn't quite make, as villainous as Juno is, she's not quite like mustache twirling.
Oh, no, no.
Like, yeah. And for instance, the way that she leaves the one woman to die, like, it was a mistake. And what is she going to do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's, you can kind of, you, and they make her the point of view character for that sequence, too. So it's like, yeah, it's kind of interesting that they still... they leave you, you're purposefully kind of meant to be like, is Sarah good or bad, or what's her 100%. Deal?
It's definitely not cut and dry. It's very gray, especially in the betrayal, as it were, of, you know, she accidentally kills her friend in the middle of fighting cave monsters.
Yeah.
And then she falls down a ravine or something, and then she just assumes she's died. And it's ridiculous to call that a betrayal.
You would assume your friend died when you put a pickaxe through the throat. I would.
Also, that having said, there's no way in hell you're getting out of that cave. Like, the worst she could have done was put out of your misery at that point.
That's true. Maybe she should have killed her. Yeah, it's an interesting time when I was kind of like, because I'm trying to think, like, what's the 2005 like horror vibe? And the interesting thing is, it's right before Hostel comes out this year, but it's at a weird time where the the kind of J-horror remake boom was fizzling out.
Yeah.
But there was this British thing with 28 Days Later and Dog Soldiers and Shaun of the Dead.
Right.
Where, and I think European as well, because I think you can put some of the French Extremity in there too.
Definitely.
Where it was this like person-based, you know, like human drama plus extreme gore situation.
Yeah.
Was kind of, and that was kind of the two streams of horror.
I think that might be my kind of horror. I think that might be why, and like that kind of quiet, like contemplative, and then everything goes to hell is kind of my thing, which also we're going to be talking about in the second movie. But okay, let's get back into the idea of we love the first half, but the second half, the monsters, you're not totally sold, Trevor. Let's talk about that.
I think that it's a super effective claustrophobic cave movie and a super effective monster mash, kind of like gore fest. And then they don't go to, they're kind of bolted together, and they go together as well as you'd think, but it's hard not to go into one or the other and then wish there was more of one or the other, like they're two different films. And also, like, the monsters are cool in design, but I it's hard not to watch them now and think they look like Buffy villains.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. With like the, the smooth face,
with
but the nose and
angry brow and the, but you know, it's a testament to the performers in the suits that they're so scary. Cause I think the design is very, you know, like, I don't want it to be too complicated, but it's a little simple and very much like, you know, some prosthetics on a dude's forehead a little bit.
I am grateful they didn't go the CGI route, though.
I was literally just thinking that. Oh, like, it would have been so easy to do something that was just completely removed from any kind of, you know, weight. Yeah, if it was between the two, I'm very happy with the route they went, for sure.
It makes it stand up more. So Paul Hyatt, who designed these creatures, also designed the Attack the Block creatures, which makes all sense in the world. Because, again, like, go ahead.
Oh, did you see that? There's an interesting thing where I think these creatures kind of led to that, where originally these guys were phosphorescent.
Oh, really?
But they found that it made it less scary.
Yeah.
Because they actually wanted them to be not visible.
Yeah.
Like, they needed them to be a little more in shadow. I think it didn't work when they glowed.
That makes sense to me, yeah.
Which the Attack the Block guys glow.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Attack the Block, I guess I should say to our listeners.
Attack the Block.
I just assume.
Those aliens are incredible. And like 9 out of 10 people you ask will be like, oh, that's CG, right? And it's not at all. It's 100% guys in big suits with some CGI overlay to make the black like super Vanta black.
Oh, okay, and, I was going to say.
And when you talk about the reveal of them in the like the incandescent sort of the infrared cameras, I always think of as kind of creating that sort of visual.
Oh, sure.
They don't. Wreck is 2007. I think it's just that they use it so well that that's kind of like the definitive, oh yeah, they did it first. That's kind of like the best way to use that infrared camera. But I think here you're kind of starting to see that now becoming like the trope of how people are going to be showing things in the dark. And makes things spookier, right? Mm. I mean, Paranormal Activity was going to use that forever afterwards.
Yeah. That jump scare, or not even a jump scare, it's the scare, I guess, where at first, for spoilers, but you know, where they're panning across the cave and you see the crawlers for the first time just standing behind her in the night vision, is, I think, one of like the two big, for me, like movie jump scares of all time.
It's real good.
That one is great because it's very still. The camera's in motion, but the figures are still. It's just because something's different that you get scared. And my other favorite one is in Exorcist 3.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And that is a very like in motion, like someone enters the frame violently in motion. So it's kind of like the two ends of the same, or two sides of the same coin for like all-timer horror movie jump scares.
You're talking about the cadet, like the rib cracker as the guy like goes back, like it's the long shot. Oh, yeah, I love that shot so much. That and the woman crawling
on
the
hallway
ceiling
with a nurse.
Oh,
yeah,
so
yeah,
good,
yeah.
So good. Oh God, I love Exorcist 3. More people need to see
so
Exorcist
good.
3. It's amazing.
I think it's finally gotten its due.
It's getting there, It's better than the first one. It is.
Oh,
it is. Better than the Exorcist.
I'm going to have... We're watching The Exorcist 3 for the upcoming, or The Exorcist 1 for the upcoming series. So I will watch that, and then I will watch 3 after it, and I will get back to you, Trevor, on my personal feelings.
I swear it's better. I'll die on that hill. It's a better film.
It does have Brad Dourif, and I will watch anything with Brad Dourif. So there's that.
Yeah, sure. I was going to say one thing that I like about this that is kind of interesting is it's a movie that I think has a lot of the good bits of like a low budget film. Where it's, you know, relying on characters, blah, 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 and very caring about tension. But then you also, when you get into the meat and potatoes of how this was made, this is a fancy movie. Like the fact that the caves do not exist, they were created by a production designer. The lighting is obviously nuts. I'm actually shocked it's just a journeyman DP, Sam McCurdy. It's like, it's kind of wild because it's like this. Yeah, this movie is very fantastic lighting and set design.
Because you can, you're right, Cam. I was thinking about this because like you can see everything, but you feel like you shouldn't be able to see everything. Like that's they've lit it just enough that it doesn't feel like there's an external light source. It's really clever.
Oh, totally.
It's a fine line to walk.
Yeah. It's crazy. So that kind of struck me where, you know, you're kind of like, ah, yes, this scrappy guy. And you're like, wait a minute, this isn't scrappy. This is very well planned out.
Yeah.
My favorite piece of trivia is that for the audition sequences for these women, they built them a little like human habit trail tunnel of like tables and chairs. And they made them do the squeeze scene in that as they like all went through it together. And I'm like, as an actor, I can't imagine walking into that room and being like, here is your tunnel. Please get into the tunnel because that's what you'll be doing for 90% of the movie. Enjoy. You know? Oh,
that would be the scene, though. That's like, that's kind of the scene in the whole movie, I think.
Yeah.
And to pull it off, like to have that as the audition, that makes total sense to me. You have to get like the camaraderie right away with the characters and also like the tension of the cave. That makes perfect sense.
And that movie sets up, or that moment sets up so many things. That's when they lose the rope bag that was saved them later on. That's where they get trapped in it. That's where like you realize, okay, is Juno actually on their side? Is she actually trying to do the best for them? Like there's so much that's set up in that one segment that's really fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One thing I just wanted to mention as well is just, again, to be like contextualizing it in the era. I find it very fascinating that the reason why the film is kind of a cult film is because its UK release was disrupted by the bombings in London.
Oh, wow.
And part of the problem was, it's actually kind of like a multifold problem. Number one, their marketing was actually focused deeply on the London Underground, which of course people weren't taking. And then also it was kind of in poor taste. And number two, it was, there's literally a poster for The Descent on the bus that exploded. So they were like, the actress was like traumatized that she's like on the bus that was bombed. And so they had to, apparently they did a fairly effective turnaround where they like made a new poster where the women are kind of like defiantly fighting. And they're like, that kind of suited the mood. But it's interesting because, yeah, I think it really took like an international release for the film to slowly gain because London was just not ready for people trapped underground terror disaster.
Yeah.
Which is... Yeah, and fascinating. It's just interesting when something like that is what disrupts it, and it's like there's nothing you can do.
No,
yeah.
And I mean, when we get into 2001, I'm sure we'll talk a whole lot about all of the things that were kind of disrupted there, of all the disrupted releases and alterations of endings. Speaking of alterations of endings, let's get into the two different versions of this one, because there's a U.S. and a UK version. Trevor, do you want to kind of walk us through the differences?
So the UK, the much preferred original ending, has Sarah is the lone survivor for many reasons. Falls down a little crevasse, and then finds this giant pile of horrible roadkill and bones and skulls that she scrambles up towards daylight and emerges through this little bush of branches that's been hidden. It's where the monsters are crawling out to kill like deer and wolves and drag them back. She runs back to her car. She gets in her car. She's hysterical, as you would expect. There's a big setup in this scene that you think, oh, she's going to get in a car accident, like the first scene. And then that'll be like the ironic, like Night of the Living Dead style death where she made it out, but she gets killed at the end. And they do a fake out with the car going by her while she's in the car parked by the side of the road, but she doesn't get hit by a car. And then she looks to her right and her dead friend is sitting there and it's a big jump scare. And that's where the American version ends, and it goes right to credits. So your idea is that she has escaped, but is horribly traumatized in kind of a Sally Hardesty Texas Chainsaw Massacre way. Mm-hmm. And that's where they built on it for the sequel, which is dog shit. But the American one after that, the European one, the original ending, has a short scene after the jump scare with their dead friend in the car, where it snaps back and she's still in the cave. She's never gotten out of the cave. And she's sitting in this little compartment with a torch in front of her, and throughout the film we've been seeing these little snippets of her dead daughter with a birthday cake, and then we finally in this last scene her daughter is there across from her with this cake, and she's like smiling beatifically at her. And then the camera kind of does this really fun movement where it pulls out and then kind of zooms around so that the cake is not in frame. And then when it goes back around, it's just her alone with a torch in this compartment, and it zooms out and she's smaller and smaller. And you hear monster sounds getting closer, and it's just the bleakest possible ending you could get. But that does not suit their idea to have like an Aliens-esque military squad go in and machine gun all the monsters in the sequel. So they had to cut it. And maybe it was just too bleak for the time. I don't know. Though we were about to enter like hostile territory.
Yeah, literally.
I mean, I'm interested. I feel like in retrospect, like a hostile territory was a lot smaller than it loomed in my mind.
Yeah. But
yeah, it's interesting.
Well, we're literally going to be talking about Wolf Creek for our last episode of this podcast. So,
I love bleak movies, but there's moments in Wolf Creek that are too fucking bleak for me.
Well, I mean, we're going to be talking about another bleak movie coming up and how much we love them. This one I think is interesting because, as you mentioned, they changed the American ending so they could have the sequel, and Neil Marshall was like, guys, you really shouldn't do a sequel. And they were like, but we're going to make a bunch of money, so that's what we're going to do. And we own the property because, as a low-budget filmmaker, you basically sold your rights to us. This is Lionsgate, who was doing a bunch of this stuff until they got the Hunger Games rights. And then it was all, you know, everybody's... It was a literal Hunger Games of film at that point. So they were like, okay, well, then we're going to do this without you. And he's like, well, can you at least run the script by me and I'll kind of give you some notes? And they were like, here you go. And he went, this is not good. And they were like, too bad. This is what we're making. Yeah. And I started watching because I was like, okay, I should probably, you know, kind of figure out what this is. I watched like 15 minutes of it and was like, this is going to ruin my enjoyment of the first film. And so I turned it off. But it's what Trevor says. It's like a military force going in, and they force her, even though she's clearly traumatized, to go back with them.
Like, they take her out of the hospital to go back.
Because she did it.
As if you would even do that with a criminal to be like, we're going back to this cave. Yeah. You would ask them where the cave is and just go yourself.
Yeah, it's pointed it from afar.
Yeah. Oh, and also there's an old crazy man, a la Texas Chainsaw Massacre, who's feeding the creatures. And
Oh, my God.
Yep.
It's interesting to me, though, that as much as he now is 100% like, don't watch the sequel, which I enjoy in interviews, he's like, yeah, it's terrible. Like you, Trevor. He agrees. I do like that he kind of is like, I don't mind the North American ending.
Oh, interesting.
Because he does say it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He says he finds that he's like, that's not a hopeful ending.
No.
It's like that woman has lost her mind. She is barely surviving. And he's kind of like, it's interesting. He says he finds the happier ending, the one where she's consumed by beasts because she's with her daughter in her mind.
That is an interesting point. Yeah.
That also tells you of what kind of a filmmaker he is. He's like, that's the happy ending, kids.
Yeah. The win is she's lost her mind so much her daughter's there rather than, and I think he's also like, she's not out in the world. She doesn't have to deal with the world anymore.
Yeah.
I think the title, The Descent, is quite possibly the greatest title because there's three completely different meanings in it. So there's the descent of going into the cave. There's the descent that these creatures are descended from humanity. They're just an offshoot of what we are. And then there's the descent of her descent into madness, right? So however you want to look at it, you're like, that is such a perfect title. It's so good.
Wow.
Oh, that's great. I only got the first one.
Let's get into something completely supernatural that has no grounding in reality. We're going to move on to our next movie, which we forced Cam to watch because he has heard me.
I liked it.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm glad because I have yelled about how much I love this movie for so long. Trevor, you love this movie as well, although we're going to get into other works of this sorely neglected filmmaker that we perhaps think should be seen equally as much, if not more. That's Noroi coming up after the break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds.
Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Japanese horror is known for many things, but for me, what they do so well is imagery and atmosphere. A perfect example of this would be the video from The Ring. A whole lot of spooky imagery followed by Sadako climbing out of the well. We love us some Gore Verbinski on the podcast, and even he knew better than to mess with that sequence and just reshot it with white people when it came time for the US remake. A number of Japanese horror movies made the jump to North America on the success of The Ring, either getting dubs and subs releases like Audition, or full-blown remakes like The Grudge. As you may expect, some of the best examples of the genre didn't make the jump and needed to be sought after throughout various web forums. Noroi, The Curse, is one such movie. It's one of my favorites, and Trevor, I know it's one of yours as well. It's also an early film by prolific horror director Koji Shirashi. This one is more spooky than violent, but content warnings for violence, the supernatural, and child endangerment and death, as well as spoilage potential, applies. Okay, Trevor, do you want to try and give us a plot summary on this one? I mean, it's not too bad.
Yeah, it's a fairly simple story when it's all laid out, but I don't want to reveal that. But it involves a paranormal investigator who, makes records his investigations into various hauntings and cursed locations and cursed shrines around Japan, which is a very prevalent thing. You can get tons of those exact types of videos in Japan, and it totally plays into the realism of this. And on his latest investigation into a horrible curse, he goes missing and his house burns down with his wife inside. And a couple days later, or I think it's like 3 months later, the company that employed him gets a mysterious box from him with a camcorder inside and a tape. So what you're watching is everything he recorded basically into this investigation, all these different pieces put together into what he's assembled in a very red string on a corkboard kind of manner, capped by what was in that on that tape that was sent to him, sent to his company after he disappeared. So the genius of this film is that whereas most found footage narratives are generally like one extremely scared person with a camera running and kind of recording as they go, it's more of like a roller coaster experience. This uses the context of that he was an investigator. He had access to all these different sources like news reports, game show clips, all kinds of stuff using different different formats of doing it. And he'd assembled it before he even went missing. So you have the context of being able to go through this whole movie and see all these different pieces fit together to tell the story. And then you get to the really, really scary bit at the very end, which we'll talk about. But that's kind of the gist of it. It's very sprawling.
When it's discussed in social circles, it is of people who like found footage. It's discussed as quite possibly the best found footage movie.
Absolutely, it is. It's definitely, there's few that do or even attempt to do what it's specifically trying to do with how ambitious it is in terms of the story and putting it together. Over any other found footage film. And it's really, really, really scary. It's very good.
Although I have to, with the caveat, I love this movie so much. I have made so many people sit down and watch it with me. And having done that, I have also come to the realization that if really, really slow builds are not for you, this is not going to be your movie. And you really have to pay attention to all of the, and especially because there's subtitles, if you are even slightly inebriated, perhaps this is not the film for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really Hear the Dots. Red String was a great way to describe it, Trevor. So, if you like that kind of stuff, this is going to be your Christmas, your Easter, and a really sunny Tuesday all in one.
It's all about the implication of various keywords popping up in different places and you drawing that own mental connection of what's happening, back and forth. It doesn't spell out a ton of stuff for you. So, you'd have to quite pay attention, I think.
Yeah, there's a good, I tried to dig up as many English language interviews with him as I could, which there aren't a ton.
He won't talk about it. He says it's...
No,
He says it, he refuses to talk about it. It's a real thing. It's incredible.
It's very fascinating. So I found one where he talked about Grotesque, his movie that got banned a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, I haven't watched it.
Don't. But,
I made it 15 minutes in. We're not talking.
Listen, about I think even he is like, you know.
Well, that's what he got. But he got, as I was, we were talking to Trevor earlier, that he got hired to do that. He got hired to make the most unwatchable, brutal film.
Yes, exactly.
Film,
that's what he
that's
says.
What
he's
he
like,
did.
He's like, they told me to make a movie that would get banned. It got banned.
Yeah. Yep.
But the thing that interested me when you're talking about like the vibe of it and how it might not be for everybody, they were like, who are your influences? And the interesting thing is he says, you know, the ones you would expect, Brian De Palma, Sam Raimi, John Carpenter. Mm-hmm. But then he says, the master of slow burn drama, Abbas Kiarostami, which I'm like, oh, damn. Like, that is kind of like, it's kind of like you made a weird horror movie that Abbas Kiarostami would make, where it's like, yeah. It's about repetition and the weird, like you slowly coming to realize the interconnectedness. And my understanding, you guys are both bigger fans of his directing work. Like quite a lot of his films are kind of interconnected conceptually.
He's got a whole cinematic, like Marvel style cinematic universe.
Trevor, do you want to get into that? He was telling me about stuff I hadn't even heard of. It gets intense.
Yeah. Like I was mentioning before, his films are kind of, split down the middle, where you get films like Grotesque and other stuff that I don't really pay attention to. It feels
there's
like
one that involves serious assault, and it's really not okay. So there's very much down the middle.
But all the spooky stuff is great, and one of the big joys of his films for me is seeing those connections that pop up that you know were completely unnecessary, but draw it into a greater like lo-fi cosmic horror hellscape universe kind of thing. Like you know, in Nora the Curse, he talks about Mr. Hori. Thank you. I was gonna say Mr. Noroi, but that's not it.
Yeah,
talks about ectoplasmic worms eating everybody.
Yes,
and he's got other movies where you see those worms. Mr. Hori's absolutely correct. In a cult, the main antagonist are those worms, and they appear to the main character in several.
They're
visions.
Called the Leech Child. It's really something.
Interesting. The thing that fascinates me the most, and is like you know my own sickness interested, is apparently he has somewhere in his filmography an erotic film that is technically in this universe, to which I'm like,
oh Lord,
okay.
He's
made like a potentially a pornographic film, but set in the worm universe, which fascinates me.
But he's got he's got Noroi, Occult, and Cult that all deal with the ectoplasmic worms in various ways. He's got a movie called A Record of Sweet Murder, which is actually a movie that it leans much more towards the grotesque side of his filmmaking canon, but the lore behind it ties deeply into the worms, where basically this character, it holds a film crew or a news crew hostage, and he's a serial killer who's been told by these worms in a vision that if he kills like 37 people or something like that, this person he loves will come back to life, and then everyone he killed will not have been killed.
And it's all shot, single shot, real time. Like, it's real intense.
Again, that sounds like an Abbas Kiarostami. That's very cool. The thing to say is, as much as this movie does have, like, when we're talking about his more extreme stuff, this movie isn't super violent.
No.
It's also, I think, a very steady hand. It is not like a gonzo
and that's
movie
part,
at all.
I mean, it's weird, because like we talked about the last one of like not seeming like a low budget. This one is also a low budget, and you can kind of see where it is, but it doesn't ever feel like a low budget.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because of the effectiveness of the effects. But you talk about this not being violent, and I think about, spoiler for the end, please go watch this movie, it's so good, where he is literally hitting a child over the head with a rock repeatedly. Like the horror of that moment, of what he is doing, if you don't believe the child is actually possessed, is nightmarish, right?
The good thing is that child is literally a physical manifestation of like
of an
eldritch horror. Not even a demon, just like the worst.
Yeah. We know.
The worst.
Yeah. The little glimpses you get in this are so good, because it's like, we don't
have
the budget.
It's all about corner of your eye.
The one shot.
And like a weird edit.
Yeah. The one shot where Mr. Hori's like, it looks like the rocks have deformed his face from smashing his face into the actual shape of the mask is so good.
Yeah.
I could talk for an hour just about Koji Shirashi's the way he works with effects and how it's tied into the way that David Lynch works with special effects, especially in the new Twin Peaks season, where I feel like it's less budgetary limitations, because there are more effective ways, even on a budget, than he works with to portray some of the stuff he does, but I feel like he is really embraced. I mean, I could be talking out of my ass, honestly, but it feels to me like he is using kind of like abstract forms of CGI, like very lo-fi forms of CGI to kind of portray and get across the otherness of like, what would it look like to encounter an actual cosmic horror that is not supposed to be in our reality? Like the way that, how strange it feels. But once you get past, it's just like, oh, it's bad CGI. The intent there feels really purposeful to me.
Just to go back to our own podcast to tie in, we talked about Wreck last season, a few years later. And that's kind of the start of what would be the North American and European boom in found footage. And the interesting thing is, I think he's inventing a lot of stuff that is just getting now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is like using digital technology glitches. But it's interesting because we looked up a lot of what made the found footage boom in the late 2000s was digital cameras were available, so suddenly it became cheap.
Of course.
But the thing is, I think at this time, it's pretty much just in Japan.
Yeah.
So, like, he is inventing, and especially the glitch scares, I think, like, he's inventing that stuff for almost certainly.
Yeah.
Because it's years before it would be used in North America or Europe.
I watched both these movies last night just for a refresher before this, but one of the big, like the scariest moment besides like the really big money shots towards the end of Noroi on last watch for me was the moment when they're first interviewing Mr. Hori and the camera glitches out and you see the wall of masks, like those blue Kagutaba masks. And then he plays it back and the slow motion of it becomes like this horrendous, like reality ripping digital scream. But I didn't realize till now that it's not just any random like spookiness. That camera is filming the end of the movie.
Yeah.
It's like it's filming when they find the the little boy Kagutaba later in the film. It's the exact same shot. So like it feels like the moment when the medium, the crazy lady, hangs herself and kind of incarnates Kagutaba into the form of the little boy, is actually ripping through time and space.
Yeah.
To this,
which is again cosmic Eldritch horror. Yeah, if you're a Lovecraft person, this is for you.
And again, I think it's like it's hard to like stress enough that I think that effect is very innovative at the time, and actually might be quite hard to pull off. To mix at the time two digital films into what looks like a realistic split.
Cam, you watched this movie for the first time, and I know when I was so I'm coming to it from a different experience as I have now watched this movie many, many times because I love it so much. But something I found on my first watch where I had to pause it, the moment that like genuinely upset me is where the actress is making the lunch and then all of a sudden she pauses and starts her head goes back and you just hear the groaning sound and then the pigeons hit the window and I was like, okay, I'm good, I need a moment. And I've also I've seen several people, this is a weird thing that happens to me in my life, I've seen several people have seizures out in public and that's what the sound they make before they start having a seizure, and it just like it's such a human but such an inhuman scary sound when it comes out that it's just like
I think one of the things that's great, and I can tie this into a movie that I know again from following Trevor on his various social medias and knowing Becky that you guys both like, which is Ghost Watch. Which one of the amazing elements of this movie is that you have an actress portraying herself as an actress who is also being incredibly creepy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the most effective parts of Ghost Watch to me is that ending where the very serious TV host gets scared and is freaked out and is being haunted. And they do that all the time throughout. And I was very interested trying to dig up who, like who these people were and like that, like the two guys with her when she goes to the cemetery
Un-girls.
Are like a weird comedy duo. It's all about how they can't get laid. And like the first woman that interviews Mr. Hori is a former adult performer that's kind of like a regular talk show guest. So she would be like, if Anna Nicole Smith was pulling up on this guy, it's very interesting to like try to understand the context, but it must be so creepy. And I know she was, this role really made her famous, so she might not have been the most famous actress ever.
Here's what was interesting about her is that she was actually known from a series of these super cute convenience store commercials. So you were seeing this, like, it was like if like a Ronald McDonald kind of showed up, you know, or like someone like super
cute. That little girl from the Pepsi ad.
Exactly. Showed up and all of a sudden was like, oh, I'm being possessed. Like, that's exactly it, right? Like, so there is that extra element of like surreality of I know you from this, and that's how you're kind of here.
And the constant drawing into the real world. And I assume that probably some of those shows are real shows, and those hosts are the real hosts. And that the content is close to what they would show on their show.
It's something I think a lot of North American people are just kind of becoming aware of, especially because of shows like Terrace House, where like them showing like the psychic thing where they're testing all the kids, and then they have like little boxes in the corners of people commenting. Yeah. That's really standard in Japan. That's what they do. Yeah. Like you're just, and so it's like you're watching along with these people. It's like a podcast that plays at the same time. But you don't really have that here, and that's also something he's satiring, which I think is really interesting, because they send the first time they send that woman to go talk to Mr. Hori, who's like, you know, the cute one, and she she's the former porn star. She's super cute, but like you can tell she's there to exploit this man who, as far as we know, is mentally ill.
And we have the graphics and stuff, and you're like, but I mean, I think that that's what one of the great things he does is that uncanny feeling, and what he does is, which is a pretty classic suspense trope, but the way he does it within you is quite different, where you as an audience member are putting this stuff together faster than anyone on screen.
Yeah.
So whenever they're joking, you're like, this is not a joke. Like here, you're like, this is bad. Yeah. This is bad. This is the same guy who was there. There's like, you're like, I know, this is the pigeon man.
It's so unique to this film. Like I was saying, I don't think there's any other found footage or fake documentary that does this, where you've had that extra level of this missing documentarian has put it together for you. So it's all the stuff that everyone in it has no idea there's anything wrong, because it's just an isolated incident, but because you have this extra knowledge, you're above everyone else in the film, including this missing man, and putting the pieces together. It's like, it's so good and so unique and good and scary.
And what's wild is that then you get the credits roll and you're like, oh, that's not the end. Then it cuts again. And then you see the footage of like, oh, holy shit, that's what happened to his family. Like, that's like next level. Blah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so good. I love it.
With you. Now, Trevor, you and I are also really big fans, and actually possibly I think I'm with you. I like Occult, the one that comes after this, slightly more, although you and I have different feelings about the endings. We're going to talk about this one briefly, because I will never get another chance to talk about this on the podcast.
We can only go so deep cut on these Japanese horror movies.
I'm hesitant to even spoil it, because you haven't seen it yet, Cameron, right?
I haven't.
We should say both of these movies, although a number of his other things are much harder to find. Both of these movies are fairly simple to get a hold of, legally, et cetera. Legally, we'll say that, yes.
Occult is a little bit more streamlined, and also not only does it have that supernatural cosmic horror that's kind of super heightened like Noroi does, but it ties it into, it feels slightly dangerous way, ties it into real life tragedy, real life terrorism, and the sarin gas attacks
The Aum Shinrikyo attacks.
Where, you know, the very brief plot, without spoiling too much, is that there's an incident where at this famous bridge in Japan, this guy shows up and starts stabbing people randomly, and this, you know, someone is there with a camcorder and happens to record it, and he ends up jumping off a cliff. The guy, the murderer, the person stabbing everyone, jumps off a cliff and just disappears. They can't find him in the ocean. They can't find where his body went at all. And then this documentary crew starts putting it together. What might've driven this guy to do it, interviewing people who were there that day and got attacked. And then it starts getting weirder and weirder, where they interview this one guy who was attacked, but he wasn't stabbed or killed. He just had this mark carved into his back. And then they find out that the guy who, you know, disappeared, who initiated this killing, this murder spree, he had a birthmark in the exact same shape as the thing that was stabbed into the other guy. And right before he jumped off the cliff, he said, "It's your turn now," to this new guy with the mark in him. And then they start finding out that everyone there that day was told to go to that bridge at that time because they had dreams that told them to be there at that point. And it just keeps, the crank keeps turning. And then they start focusing on this guy who, you know, got this mark carved into his back. And what he's all about. And he's like, "Oh yeah, I see like miracles every single day. I see ghosts every day." And he's a guy who is like kind of living on the street. He's got no money. And they basically say, "If we can film you for a day, we'll give you a place to stay in the office. And we will pay you for this.
And they start kind of building like a friendship with this guy,
yeah.
right? Like, it's not meant to be exploitative. It's meant to, like, initially starts out as that. And then it's like, no, he's like our buddy. And like, he lives yeah. here and we feed him and we hang out. And
yeah. And then it gets worse. And then it gets into the implication of like the line between you're filming this guy and you're complicit in whatever this guy might be up to starts becoming very, very thin. It gets rough.
Without ruining it, it's like it's bleak in a similar way that Noroi is bleak, and that ending is like, oh, we're now all doomed. Like, this child is going to bring the end. But this one, Trevor, I think you'd agree with me, is so much more grounded in reality and the terror mm-hmm. of like, oh, is this guy mentally ill or is there something bigger? Which you then find out, yes, there's something bigger. But it's still what the human capacity for evil and danger and the exploitation of that. And it's a fascinating exploration of it, and the way it's pieced together, it's really
it's so good.
Not for everybody.
Yeah, the soundtrack alone is just this roiling, grinding industrial metal noise. That's the most off-putting, like unsettling soundtrack I've ever heard. I think, like the soundtrack to Noroi was just the soundtrack to the thing, 100%. But this soundtrack is really effective. And yeah, it has an ending that I'm not going to reveal, but I really, really want to talk about it because it's so divisive. Every single review of a cult is like, it's an incredible movie, so good until that ending, and it just ruined the whole thing for me.
Yeah,
and I'm like one of like two people I've ever met is like, you have to keep that ending exactly as it is. It ties in very much to what I was saying just briefly about him using effects that on their surface look very shoddy and cheap to kind of get across these otherworldly concepts. The idea behind the very last scene in A Cult is so frightening to me on like a base like level that its portrayal could kind of be in any way, shape, or form, and I would still find it really scary. But the way that it is so surreal and off-putting that it just heightens it for me. It's really good. It's a really good movie.
No, yeah.
It's available online. You should watch it.
Also taking Koji Shirashi as well is in that movie playing himself. Like, he is the film crew. So he starts, again, that really, again, blurring the lines of reality and fantasy. What is this? So, it's, again, I think he's a really underseen filmmaker. And, like, again, big line down the middle of his work of the super ultra-violent and the more spooky atmospheric. Both of them equally terrifying. This is what this person does, and he's very, very good at it. So I think that's the best place we can leave this. So Cameron Maitland, thank you once again for joining us.
Thanks. And if he doesn't want to big up himself, I will say check out all of Trevor's creepy monsters. There's many. Siren Head's just the beginning, you guys.
Well, thank you.
Talk to a child, they can miss them all.
They sure can. And Trevor Henderson, please, thank you for being here, and please tell us how we can see more of your scary monsters.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This was super fun. I'm on Twitter way too much at Slimy Swamp Ghost, all one word.
Great movie recommendations. As I say, you're a wonderful source.
Thank you.
Just talking about especially deep cut movies like this that I can dig up, and you'll show a great image, and I'll just be like, what? I gotta see that.
The only reason I have a big following online is to just get people to watch like weird crap and just be able to recommend stuff like that. But if you want to see more of my art with less like movie reviews and crap like that, my Instagram is Trevor Henderson, all one word, and that's just art for the most part, I think.
Every now and then there's a I'm sure there's a movie review Instagram coming where you're just pointing at things going, this is great.
If I get a Blu-ray, I'll post it there every once in a while, but mostly it's art.
It's always such a pleasure to have someone who's so passionate about what they do and about movies on, so thank you so much for coming here and sharing your passion and my passion as well, because I really wanted to talk about these movies, so thank you.
Same, thank you so much.
All right, and you can join us next week where things are going to get a little soft, a little fuzzy, because we're going to be looking at The Curse of the Were-Rabbit and The Corpse Bride. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen, on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton.
and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today, featured Cameron Maitland and Trevor Henderson as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.